From WVUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. How will the abundantly talented team Venezuela fare against the favored teams from the Dominican Republic, Japan, and the United States in the World Baseball Classic? Ahead on Only a Game, we'll hear from players on Venezuela's roster. Also, profiles of two legendary hockey coaches chasing the all-time career wins record, each in the other's shadow. Also ahead, adaptive rowing technology makes the sport available to all, regardless of age, ability, or disability.
This is going to be one of the pillars of our program. We've got this amazing cross-section of athletes that have been absolutely at the top of their game. It's remarkable.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Once again, it has rolled around, that excellent portion of the baseball season when nobody cares about the losses, but the wins are still energizing. These are the days when, even if he's throwing a no-hitter, the pitcher comes out after a few innings at most and rambles around in the outfield chatting with his teammates. Joining me now to discuss the joys of spring training and perhaps some of the disappointments various teams are doomed to suffer thereafter is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be here.
At first, it was reported that Alex Rodriguez would need surgery for a cyst on his hip and that he would be out for about 2 months. Now we've learned that he has a torn labrum in that hip, which, if it requires surgery, would keep A-Rod out for as long as 4 months. What do you think? Do the Yankees get off to a good start without him?
No, I don't think they can. You know, Bill, they were not a particularly good offensive team last year. And now if they lose their middle-of-the-order best hitter, they're going to have a lot more trouble scoring runs this year. So this is what the Yankees are trying to do. They are going to hope that with rest and rehab that this problem is going to go away. The danger is, of course, if he tries to rehab this for a month and a half and he gets to, say, the middle of April and it's still bothering him and he needs the surgery, then he might miss the entire season. And I'm not sure the Yankees can make the playoffs with A-Rod missing the entire season.
Whatever else fans of the Mariners may have to complain about, they can't say the front office hasn't given them a sentimental favorite to root for. How do you like the return of Ken Griffey Jr. to Seattle?
Well, I think it's a great thing for him. It's a great thing for the Mariners. It's a great thing for the game. I love it when guys go back to the place where they were stars. The only danger is, Bill, and let's not kid ourselves about this, Ken Griffey Jr. isn't even close to the player he was when he left Seattle. He can't play center field anymore. He's got a bad knee. But, you know, if they use him properly, use him as the DH here and there, just fill in the outfield, he could hit 20 more homers this year, and he could put some people in the seats in Seattle, which is extremely important. So definitely the place he should be for the end of his career.
Elsewhere, on the old guy front, the Boston Red Sox have employed John Smoltz, and the word is that he'll be ready to go on or about June 1st. After all those years with the Braves, does he immediately begin baffling American League hitters?
Well, I don't think immediately, because he's coming off shoulder surgery, and the Red Sox aren't even counting on him until June because they really don't need him. What they need him for is to pitch in, say, Yankee Stadium in August and September and win a big game down the stretch. Smoltz is going to want much more than that because, Bill, other than Cal Ripken, he is the most competitive baseball player I've ever met. He confirmed this story for me once, that he played a friend of his in ping pong, and of course he beat him because John Smoltz wins at everything. Then he says to his friend, "I'll beat you playing left-handed." So he beat him playing left-handed, and then he looks at his friend and says, "I'll beat you playing from my knees." So John Smoltz got down on his knees and beat his friend in ping pong. That's who John Smoltz is. So don't tell me he's not up for a new challenge here. He is.
All right, the Phillies won it all last fall. No National League team has won the World Series in consecutive years since the Cincinnati Reds of Pete Rose et al. More than 30 years ago. Are the Phils significantly better or worse now than they were in October, Tim?
I think they're slightly slightly better than they were last year for a couple reasons. They kept almost everyone from the championship team except for Pat Burrell, their left fielder, and replaced him with Raul Ibanez, who I think is a slight upgrade, even though he hits left-handed and they have a lot of left-handed hitters on their team. Now they really believe that they can do this. And Jimmy Rollins, their shortstop, was saying the other day, he says, we're the Phillies. You know, we basically have more losses than any team in the history of baseball. We can't just do it 1 year. We have to do it 2 years in a row at least.
I read an article about the Mets this week that suggested that they're going to go with the so-called small ball strategy, meaning they'll try to steal bases rather than hit home runs. Is that a strategy born of choice or necessity?
I think it's choice. They can still hit a lot of home runs with that team. But, you know, the Rays, the Tampa Bay Rays, proved last year that you don't have to be a great hitting team in order to get to the World Series. The Rays got there with great defense. They got there with really good pitching. And a lot of teams are going that direction also. Home runs aren't the key factor for some teams anymore. And teams like the Mets say, let's find more ways to score runs. And I think that's a good idea.
All right, it's time for you to offer us your can't-miss absolute lock picks for the postseason. And I probably don't have to say this, Tim, don't have to remind you, but the tape is running.
Well, I'm going to have different picks next week, but here we go, and I'm going to stick with them for the entire year because, again, this is the beauty of baseball is even the guys who cover it every day for a living like me, we're always wrong. It's great. Okay, here goes. I think Boston's going to win the East, and Tampa Bay is going to win the wild card. The Indians are going to win the Central. I think the Angels are going to win the West. In the National League, I think the Phillies are going to win the division. The Mets are going to win the wild card. The Cubs are going to win the Central, and the Dodgers are going to win the West. And I think the Red Sox are going to play the Cubs in the World Series, and for the first time in 101 years, the Cubs are going to win the World Series. How's that sound? Pretty good?
Yeah, and as long as you know you're not going to be right, why not pick the Cubs?
Precisely.
ESPN's Tim Kirkjian joins me from time to time to talk about baseball. Always a delightful thing for me. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
The second World Baseball Classic began on Thursday in Tokyo, where defending champion Japan defeated China 4-0 and Korea drubbed Chinese Taipei 9-0 in round one play. Korea and Japan will tangle this morning. Today in Toronto, the U.S. faces Canada and Italy takes on Venezuela. As only a game's Ron Schachter found earlier this week in Lakeland, Florida, Team Venezuela is hoping its roster of Major League talent will make its mark in this year's WBC.
Last Tuesday's spring training game hosted by the Detroit Tigers at Joker Marchand Stadium began with the American and Venezuelan national anthems. But Detroit slugger Gary Sheffield was still standing at attention when Team Venezuela's starting lineup was announced.
Left field, number two, Carlos Guillen. Left field.
Deadly. They're deadly. You know, you look at all those guys over there, they have a bunch of superstars. I don't know who their pitching staff is, but I know the hitters.
That's in part because three of those hitters, third baseman Carlos Guillen, first baseman Miguel Cabrera, and outfielder Maglio Ordóñez, who were wearing the bright yellow and deep red uniforms of Team Venezuela, ordinarily dress next to Sheffield in the Tigers' locker room. Cabrera's credentials include his annual average of almost 35 homers and 120 RBIs for the past 5 years. In 2007, Ordóñez knocked in a career-high 139 runs, and new Los Angeles Angel Bobby Abreu, with his 7 consecutive 100-plus RBI seasons, rounds out a veritable Venezuelan murderer's row. Still, manager Luis Soho says his team has a lot to prove after losing in the second round of the inaugural WBC 3 years ago.
We don't prepare in 2006, and I believe this year they got their mindset to get better, to get it done. Because we look a lot better this year. I mean, the guys are in better shape, and I believe we're going to do a better job.
Venezuela would be one of the favorites in this year's tournament if they had Mets starting pitcher and two-time Cy Young Award winner Johan Santana, as well as Cubs ace Carlos Zambrano. They would be followed by almost untouchable closer Francisco Rodriguez, who set a major league record with 62 saves last year. But both Santana and Zambrano are rehabbing from arm injuries and currently unavailable. Venezuelan journalist Carlos Caicedo is covering the team in the WBC and says fans in his country are finding it hard to understand the absence of the two star pitchers.
Injuries are in the game for everybody. But if you love your country, you have to put your heart in your country, because country gave you the life. Then why do you give the life back to your country, to your family, to your people?
Team Venezuela will rely instead on young Seattle starter Felix Hernandez and second-year Tiger Armando Galarraga, who threw against the Tigers on Tuesday and has long impressed Tigers manager Jim Leland.
We think he's awful good. He won 14 games for us last year. I mean, obviously, you know, it doesn't sound quite as good as Santana, to be honest with you. But they don't play that many games. They're short series, and those kids can drum up a good game in a heartbeat.
There are almost 50 Venezuelan players on major league rosters, and hundreds more in the minor leagues. That's a Latin American contingent second only to that of the vaunted Dominican Republic. Team Venezuela's Carlos Guillen notes that his country has been catching up.
Well, one day maybe we match with those guys, because we're coming along good. We've been growing, you know. We've been doing better every year, you know. A lot of young players coming up very quickly. So we got a pretty good talent down there, because every kid wants to play baseball.
The prospects of continued player development in Venezuela have become clouded in recent years because of tension between the United States and the socialist government of President Hugo Chavez, and uncertainty of how that will affect his country's baseball exports. Some major league teams have closed their Venezuelan baseball academies, which have nurtured young players and paved their way to the United States. Orioles third baseman Melvin Mora came through one of those facilities.
I wish we can have more academy over there, some people can have the opportunity to play. But, you know, that's not dependent on us. Dependent on the United States to go to Venezuela to explore all the people we have there.
Vamos, suénalo!
During Tuesday's sunny exhibition against the Tigers, though, politics stayed on the sidelines as dozens of Venezuelan fans, seated near third base and wearing the country's red, yellow, and blue colors, provided their own soundtrack to the game. One of those fans, Miguel Zambrano, sat wrapped in a Venezuelan flag.
For me, I used to play baseball too, and come out here so far and watch one of the best teams in the world. I was pretty excited. I thought that we didn't have enough Venezuelan people in Lakeland, but I guess we do.
Tonight in Toronto, the Venezuelans play Italy in round one of the WBC. If they can advance to round two next weekend in Miami, they'd likely meet up with the Dominican Republic, with the chance to avenge two losses in the 2006 World Baseball Classic. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. A recent article updating the madcap adventures of former tennis champion Boris Becker includes this sentence. He fathered a child with a Russian model after a brief sexual encounter in the laundry cupboard of a Japanese restaurant in London after his final Wimbledon match while his wife was pregnant. Russian model? Sexual encounter in the laundry cupboard while his wife was pregnant? This week, Boris Becker announced his most recent engagement on a German game show, which would be relatively intriguing and might even rank as bizarre were it not for Russian model, sexual encounter in the laundry cupboard, and so on. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, March Madness in Sin City. But first, there are only three coaches in the history of men's college hockey with more than 800 career wins. Two of them coach teams that are less than 5 miles apart, play in the same conference, and make up one of the sport's greatest rivalries. With one game left in the regular season, Boston College head coach Jerry York has 818 victories. Boston University's Jack Parker has 807. Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports.
It's early February, and the TD Bank North Garden is hosting a New England sports tradition, the Beanpot Tournament. Every year, Boston University, Boston College, Harvard University, and Northeastern University vie for local bragging rights. In the consolation game, Jerry York's BC Eagles have just beaten Harvard 4-3, but at the end of his press conference, the coach, like most people in the arena, is looking forward to the final.
This should be a terrific game here, this next one. I think it's going to be a really good game.
Asked for a prediction, York remains neutral.
No, I'm going to just enjoy it. I don't have to root for anybody.
Coming into the final, BU is ranked first in the nation and Northeastern third. The Terriers put up two shorthanded goals less than a minute apart in the third period to pull away for a 5-2 win. It's BU's 29th victory in the 57-year history of the Beanpot Tournament. Jack Parker has coached 21 of those wins, but after the game, it's clear the tournament still holds a special meaning for him.
I told the guys before the game, I guarantee you, you will remember this game as long as you live, so make sure you have good memories of it, and they will.
Although Jack Parker and Jerry York did not face each other in this year's Beanpot, the two men have coached against each other at least three times a season since 1994. But they've been meeting in ice rinks for more than four decades. Both men were born in Massachusetts, just outside of Boston, in 1945. York in Watertown, Parker in Somerville. Both attended Catholic high schools and played on opposing hockey teams. Parker attended BU, York went to BC. Both played hockey and were team captains as seniors. Jerry York got his first head coaching job at Clarkson University in Potsdam, New York, in 1972. In 7 years, he had five winning seasons, and in 1979, he accepted the head coaching job at Bowling Green State University. In his fifth season in Ohio, the Falcons won a national title. York says during the excitement after the win, he took time to focus on what had gotten them there.
What did we just do? You know, how do we develop this program? What was this team? Why was this special and different from some of the other teams that couldn't win a national title? And I think that's helped us, my staff, my assistants, myself, in the next step here.
Jack Parker joined the coaching staff at BU as a graduate assistant and a few years later became the head coach in 1973. In 1978, the Terriers beat BC in the NCAA finals to claim BU's third national championship and Parker's first. Parker says it was a weight off his shoulders.
I was more relieved than anything else because we had been to the Final four straight years and didn't win it and really didn't play that well in a couple of those. And it was an All-East final, and I think BC and BU were both very proud of that.
Parker had a winning record in the 80s, but in 1989 he wanted a change and agreed to become BU's athletic director. 2 weeks after the announcement, Parker knew he'd made a mistake and asked for his old job back. The university president immediately obliged, and judging by BU's record, Parker made the right decision. In the 1990s, the Terriers qualified for the NCAA tournament 9 times and won the national title in 1995. In 2005, BU opened the Aganis Arena and named the Terriers' home ice the Jack Parker Rink. The success has continued, and this season, in late January, Parker earned his 800th win. He has more wins at one school than any other hockey coach.
And move over Mason and move over York. You got company in that 800-win club in the history of college hockey.
Bernie Corbett with the call on 1510 The Zone. Parker says motivational speeches are overrated and players should get inspiration from within. But BU assistant coach Mike Bavis, who played for BU from 1989 to 1993, says Parker inspires his teams in other ways.
The players see how passionate he is, and more times than not, that carries into their play and how they carry themselves and prepare to play. So I think he doesn't realize sometimes that just his mannerisms, his emotion, his passion, that becomes your identity as a team.
York joined BC in 1994 and suffered through a losing season. But since then, the Eagles have made 8 Frozen Four appearances. In 2001, BC won its first national championship since 1949. And last season, York earned his 800th win by beating Minnesota in the opening round of the NCAA tournament. But there was a bigger prize just ahead.
The 2008 national champions are the Boston College Eagles.
Dan Parkhurst with the call on the Boston College ISP Sports Network. The 2008 victory over Notre Dame gave York his 3rd national title. The only coach ahead of York and Parker on college hockey's all-time wins list is Ron Mason. Mason compiled 924 victories at Lake Superior State, Bowling Green, where he preceded York, and Michigan State during a 36-year coaching career that ended in 2002. He says because hockey is smaller than some sports, there are fewer opportunities for coaches to develop great legacies.
Basketball has 300 coaches, and football has 100 and some coaches, and at the major level, and 300th overall. And hockey is really a special group. And to be in that group that long, like I was, and Jerry and Jack, boy, that says something. And I think we're all proud of that.
Mason says discipline is something else Parker and York have in common. At BC, York's rules require the team bus to leave on time, no matter who's on it, and prohibit players from sporting any facial hair. BC senior forward and team captain Brock Bradford says York emphasizes discipline without creating a stressful environment.
I love that coach is, you know, kind of an even keel person. He's a very spiritual person, so he doesn't like to swear. He's very calm, and he's not going to treat the team any differently when you're losing or when you're winning.
Parker says despite their deep ties to their respective schools and the success of both programs, he and York don't see themselves as the faces of the BU-BC rivalry.
Jerry and I have already had our rivalry. We played against each other in college, and that was done with. We're not trying to beat Jerry York, or Jerry York's not trying to beat Jack Parker. BU's trying to beat BC. People are more concerned about that game than any other games we play.
Both Parker and York appear to have a good shot at passing Ron Mason's record of 924 victories, but York says hockey coaches can't look that far ahead.
It's just too difficult for us to, and Jack probably feels the same way. We're looking at, you know, who do we play this weekend? What's it? You know, you just can't get involved in trying to reach milestones, and we tell our players the same thing. You got to stay right in the present, and you've got to really be conscious of where you are right now because, hey, you know, we're living today, but nobody guarantees us tomorrow, right?
Looking just a little bit ahead, Jerry York and Jack Parker's next challenge will be trying to win another trophy, this time in the Hockey East Tournament, which begins Friday. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
When the NCAA basketball tournaments begin in mid-March, televisions across the land begin to glow and nobody changes the channel. And for some, that's not enough. Seeking a kind of action to which people actually attending the games have no access, these people go to Las Vegas. There, in lots of casino sports books, they can bet on as many as 48 games in 72 hours. That phenomenon struck Alan J. Zaremba as an extraordinary opportunity to conduct some informal sociological and anthropological research, and the result is his new book, The Madness of March. Alan Zaremba joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much for having me.
You conclude at several points in The Madness of March that most of the men you meet know that they're going to lose money betting on these basketball games. Why do they keep coming back?
It's fun. They keep coming back because it's fun. Most people are going to lose in Las Vegas. It's a good time. It's like going to a sports bar, hanging around with pals who are like-minded, getting a lot of laughs, having exciting moments, hearing cheering, and drinking beer. So I think that this is an experience that people go to in the same way they go to an amusement park. Why do people go to Disney World? They know they're not going to come out with more money. They just know they're going to have a good time. It's going to be a fun ride.
You surmise that many, many people betting on college basketball games might be capable of putting pressure on the men coaching those games. Did you ever see any evidence of that?
No. And to be clear, what I saw was comical T-shirts, you know, good coaches win, great coaches cover. So this was a...
Meaning cover the spread.
They cover the spread. I mean, all sorts of cries would come out of the crowd when a coach would inexplicably not foul, or somebody would scream something like, lose like a man, instead of trying to score more points that might cover the spread.
I think my favorite gambler among the guys you profile is the fellow that you meet while you're both waiting in line to place bets, and he tells you that you're a sure winner if you'll just listen to his bets and then go exactly the opposite way. Were you tempted to follow that system?
I would have been, except for the fact that he must have been the 10th person who told me that. That it was very common for someone to get on a line, wait in a long queue, to give money away, and then when you asked them who they liked, they would say, listen to me and do just the opposite. One fellow kept wailing, the only luck I have is bad luck. The only luck I have is bad luck, while he waited on a line to give his money away.
You did do some betting yourself during the 2007 trip. How'd you make out?
I lost. I didn't lose a lot because I don't bet a good deal. I bet $5 on a game and maybe $10 if I have a sure thing.
Or a pretend sure thing, because none of your locks end up being, or very few of them.
Very few. Yes. Very few. You would listen to a tip from somebody who is inebriated and think that would be a good idea to throw my money away. No, I would lose. You can't really win if you bet frequently enough, and I would bet $5 a game for most of the games.
Well, maybe the secret is to not have a clue as to what you're doing, because I love the guy that you meet in line who asks you how to place a bet, and you patiently tell him how to do it, and then he reveals that he doesn't know yet which team he's going to bet on, and he'll wait till he gets up to the front of the line to decide.
Right, and he wins.
Twice.
He won. This is a fellow who didn't know who he was going to bet on, told me that he was going to bet $100 on a game. I laughed at him. He won. I lost.
There is a pattern of sorts in this book. You refer to one group of gamblers as, quote, four idiots from Vanderbilt well into inebriation. Elsewhere, we find a family of overweight people gorging themselves at the buffet, and you wonder, quote, whether there should be some restrictions on this. You meet a man named Mikey and refer to him as, quote, a lunatic, and you overhear another man talking on the phone, and you speculate that his wife is probably very glad that he's not home because he's such a slob. Were you contemptuous of a lot of the people about whom you wrote?
No, not at all. The fellow who I wondered about whether his wife was glad he left the house, he just was a peculiar sort of fellow, and he was, I could see how someone might want to have a vacation from this personality. But not at all. I wasn't contemptuous, and I look forward to meeting these people. The point of this is a positive thing. These people have a love for something. Some people overdo it. It is pretty weird for someone to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to save a seat. But I like these people, not contemptuous at all.
So getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to save a seat and then betting on whether one team or the other is likely to take the last foul shot in a game, this doesn't necessarily constitute a gambling problem.
I don't think so. I think if beyond the 4 days of March Madness you kept coming back, that would be something else. These are people, I believe, who go out for their annual vacation with their college cronies. I don't see these people as the folks who visit the neighborhood bookie. They're just going out for this weekend. So I think it's part of the excitement. It's like a little boy on his birthday can't wait for the sun to come up because that's when he's going to get his presents. These people, when they go to Las Vegas, they can't wait for that Thursday morning because that's when this fun starts.
Alan J. Zaremba is the author of The Madness of March, Bonding and Betting with the Boys in Las Vegas, published by University of Nebraska Press, and he joined me right here in the studio. Alan, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Only a Game. The emails we received this week established that a lot of people who fondly remember the Bill Mazeroski home run that won the 1960 World Series listen to Only a Game. My conversation on last week's program with Jim Reisler about the greatest game ever, Mr. Reisler's account of that home run and that Pittsburgh Pirates team, reawakened memories across the globe. Jim Foster, who hears the show on WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, wrote to say that he still has a brick from what used to be the outfield wall of Forbes Field in Pittsburgh. He keeps it next to pictures of Willie Stargell and Roberto Clemente. Zeno Henniger, who listens to the show on the Internet from Echternachebruck, Germany, emailed to say, "Thanks for the mention of Game 7 of the 1960 World Series. I was in fifth grade, and we were listening to the game on the school intercom in Butler, Pennsylvania. When Mr. Mazeroski's hit won the game, our teacher, Mrs. Guiteau, jumped over the desk. We did not mess with her for the remainder of the year." Larry Campbell, who hears the program on WEOS in Geneva, New York, enjoyed the discussion of the best game ever, too, but wondered as follows in his email, "How can you talk about that game without mentioning the deacon, Vernon Law, without whom there wouldn't have been a seventh or even a sixth game, or the bad hop that Tony Kubek couldn't handle that kept the game alive? I guess maybe we should have given over the whole hour to that interview. But if we'd done that, there wouldn't have been room for Karen Given's story about the adult gymnastics program in New York City, a story about which Hannah Azuma Chang emailed, "This is now my favorite one. I've yearned for an adult gymnastics class for years. Thanks for having this wonderful program. I hope to hear more in the future." All this is not to suggest that we can please all the people all the time. Alicia Lenahan, who hears only a game on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, was not entirely pleased when Sports Illustrated writer Damon Hack maintained last week that no other athlete had carried a sport on his shoulders the way Tiger Woods has done with the PGA Tour. "I love watching Tiger," Ms. Lenahan wrote, "but I think Seabiscuit deserves credit for not only carrying a sport on his shoulders, but also carrying the hopes of a nation when we really needed a hero." Should you wish to nominate another two- or four-legged athlete for celebration, or if you want to contact us for any other reason, you can do so through our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860, or you can drop us a line at onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Monday was celebrated as Square Root Day by those who keep track of such things. Monday was the third day of the third month, and if you multiply 3 by 3, you get 9, which in 2009 qualifies Monday as a Square Root Day. In Redwood City, California, teacher Ron Gordon started a contest. Here comes the sports connection to get his students excited about Square Root Day. The producer of the biggest Square Root event was to get $339. Some participants cut root vegetables into squares. Others made food in the shape of the square root symbol. Oh, the fun they had. The next Square Root Day is April 4th, 2016, so get ready. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, row, row, row your erg, and that's not a typo. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The University of Connecticut women's basketball team finished their regular season undefeated and untied, although not quite unscored upon. Were you a betting man? Would you bet on them to sail unscathed through the tournament?
I think if the University of Connecticut loses in this year's NCAA women's tournament, it will be the biggest upset in the history of college basketball, men's or women's. They're that much better than everyone else.
This week, the Cleveland Cavaliers became the first NBA team to assure itself of a playoff berth. How likely is it that LeBron et al. Will win the championship this spring?
you know, once again, I mean, they've got to get through the defending champions before they even get a chance at it. I do see them beating any team out of the West, though.
Brian Scalabrine of the Boston Celtics will not play again until April 1st, probably, after suffering 3 concussions in a month. So, have the Celtics been A, appropriately cautious in their handling of Scalabrine, or B, not sufficiently conservative in allowing him to return to play after concussion number 2 within a month?
I think both. I think they're certainly doing the right thing now. I think there should have been a warning sign. The second concussion took place in a game, and it didn't look like he got hit that hard, which should have been a warning that maybe he's a little bit prone to these things at this point, because it really was almost unnoticeable, the contact.
The Terrell Owens era in Dallas is over. The wide receiver was released by the Cowboys this week. Do you think team owner Jerry Jones pulled a Sharpie out of his sock and signed Owens' walking papers with a dramatic flourish? That would have been appropriate.
I think Terrell Owens is lucky Jerry Jones didn't sign his walking papers on his forehead at this point. But I think it looks like he's going to wind up back in San Francisco, where all this started in the first place.
Kansas City Mayor Mark Funkhauser's budget proposal this week included the elimination of about $2 million the city contributes each year to the operation of the Truman Sports Complex, where the Chiefs and the Royals play their home games. Are Jackson County Executive Mike Sanders' concerns well-founded?
Well, obviously, the blackmail will begin now. If you don't give us this money, and if you don't take this money away from urgent social and cultural needs and give us to our football gate team and our baseball team, we'll lose our football and our baseball teams. Oh, no. My question is, if the Kansas City Royals left Kansas City, would anybody in America care?
The opening game of the World Baseball Classic was won by defending champion Japan. They were playing in Tokyo before a full stadium, over 43,000 people. Are fans in the U.S. missing a good thing in not apparently caring as much as folks elsewhere do about this tournament?
Yeah, I mean, this is the same thing we hear during the World Cup and everything else. We are somehow, except for the occasional Olympics, immune to the kind of supranational sporting events that the rest of the world seems to enjoy. So, yes, I do think they are. Of course, the American team is not exactly the creme de la creme, whereas, you know, most of the stars from the other countries of the world are playing for their teams.
I read this week that the team Derek Jeter is playing for beat the Yankees. When did he get traded?
He got traded to the United States of America. and Team USA managed to beat the Yankees, who were obviously missing Derek Jeter.
Among others. We talked a little last week, Charlie, about sudden personnel changes in the front office of the Washington Nationals. This week, the team named a replacement for general manager Jim Bowden, who resigned, but indicated that Mike Rizzo, the new guy, would not have final say on such matters as usually concern general managers. So they're all set, right?
I think so. The president of the team, Stan Kasten, is going to make most of the major personnel moves, apparently. But that franchise is just such a piece of flotsam at this point that I'm not sure anybody really wants to be associated with any decision they make.
In the much-beloved children's story Pinocchio, a little boy's nose grows whenever he tells a lie. In Major League Baseball, do you get a cyst on your hip or a torn labrum when you prevaricate?
Apparently, Alex Rodriguez is having all sorts of bad things visited upon him since his admission that he did indeed use performance-enhancing drugs, maybe, probably, back in the day. So I leave it to you whether or not this is a curse from above or not.
Having determined that no other team would pay him more than $45 million for 2 years of baseball, Manny Ramirez has re-signed with the Dodgers, for whom he hit .396 in 53 regular season games at the end of last season. So, more money? Does Manny hit about .500 this year?
I think Manny will have the best year he's had in 5 years this year. I predict that right now. And there will be some incidents, as there always are, but he will be in the running for National League Most Valuable Player this year.
Jeff Boris, the agent representing Barry Bonds, announced this week that now that his client's trial has been postponed, Bonds is available. So let's just listen for a few seconds. Is that the sound of Jeff Boris' phone not ringing?
If the phone don't ring, you'll know it's Jeff Boris' house. Although it's hard to believe that Barry Bonds won't at this point somehow wind up with the Washington Nationals.
As if soccer Goliath Manchester United wasn't strong enough, they have apparently distinguished themselves as the first team to take advantage of iPod technology. Last Sunday, Man U goalkeeper Ben Foster studied images of the opposing players taking penalty kicks in order to get an edge on them, and this was while the game was being played. Are you surprised to learn that this was, in fact, well within the rules?
Of course, it's within the rules. It's not that dissimilar to American football quarterbacks studying Polaroids between series of downs, which they do all over the NFL now.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I don't find this that much difference at all. Of course, I'm sure the busybodies at FIFA will get involved with banning this fairly soon.
Well, maybe so, but I would love to be a fly on the wall as somebody tries to explain to the busybodies of FIFA exactly what an iPod is.
And more to the point, why they don't make any money from them.
This is a situation that must be remedied, I should think. Being a referee in a soccer game is hard work under the best of circumstances, but officiating a game involving the Italian club known as Team De Feo must be especially challenging, don't you think?
Yes, because everybody on Team De Feo is named De Feo. The coach is named De Feo. They play on a stadium that's on De Feo Street. This is tremendous. How'd you like to be the person who types up the box score ragged for the local newspaper, which I'm fairly sure will be called Il Giorno De Feo?
I'm sure of it, and I'd also like to be the guy fielding the complaints from one De Feo who thinks he should have gotten the assist that another De Feo got credit for.
I think they make that up.
And finally, Charlie, the NBA's plan to market a jersey based on Nate Robinson's spectacular slam dunks has hit a snag. Robinson, who's only 5 feet, 7.5 inches tall, has developed the alter ego Kryptonate, the antidote to fellow dunker Dwight Howard's Superman shtick, cape included. Marketing Kryptonate shirts would seem to be a natural, but not so fast, huh?
You do not mess with Superman. DC Comics has stepped in and said, we want our piece. And the NBA has stepped out saying, well, maybe we don't want this.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he shares his plutonium stash with us each week at this time as well on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Okay, so this is a first, what you're going to see here today. We're going to arrange these athletes into doubles boat. And that boat is going to go at a pace that reflects the combined performance of these two.
On a cold February morning in the community rowing boathouse in Brighton, Massachusetts, Peter Lufin, who has traveled here from New Zealand, explains the intricacies of a competition that would likely strike most observers as not only novel, but bizarre. First, the boats to which Peter Lufin refers aren't boats. They are high-tech indoor rowing machines called ergometers, and they're connected via the computer software Lufin has developed to a projector that will indicate on a cyber river on a big screen in the front of the room which of the six rowing teams is ahead in the race that will see them all going exactly nowhere.
It'll be very interesting to see how this unfolds. This is a world first. It's never been done before.
Well, I will watch these little cyber rowers and see if I can tell what's going on.
That's it.
Six teams of two rowers each gallantly pull at their oars. Some of them are men and some are women. Some of them are young and some of them are mature. And some of them are blind and some of them have climbed into the rowing machines from wheelchairs and one of them was born with spina bifida. You won! Surprised?
No. Not at all.
The unsurprised member of the winning team is 19-year-old Oksana Masters, who traveled to Brighton from her home in Louisville, Kentucky, for this competition. She's wearing workout pants and a blue jersey, and as she climbs out of the rowing machine, it's not immediately evident what qualifies her for participation in this first indoor adaptive rowing challenge, an event designed to demonstrate how disabled athletes can benefit from the sport. So I asked.
Well, I'm a bilateral knee dysarthric, so I'm missing both of my legs through the knee. I had my left one done in 97, and then my right one about five summers ago now. So.
And why was that?
Well, I was originally from Ukraine, and there's a lot of nuclear power plants, and they think that I was in a nuclear power plant when I was in my mom's birth stomach. I was born with legs, but they were just so deformed and like other parts of my body were like some deformed inside, so they think it was radiation poison and all that kind of stuff.
I mentioned that the prosthetic legs don't seem to have hindered her efforts on the ergometer.
I know, I love it. Life is good. Can't ask for anything better.
In fact, the only complaint Oksana Masters has in this cozy boathouse beside the partly frozen Charles River concerns the screen upon which her performance is represented by that cartoon boat moving smoothly along a lovely blue river between green and shaded banks.
No, it's so distracting to have that there, and I keep wanting to go there, and my coach is like, stop looking, and it's almost like, ah.
What are you supposed to be looking
exactly
at?
Exactly, that's what I'm saying, but he goes, just focus and breathe, and I'm just like, okay.
Oksana Masters isn't the only rower who's frustrated by the computer graphics. Andrew Johnson has heard that they're not as accurate as they might be at representing the rowers.
My mom was telling me that there are actually pictures of the people in the boats. And she was looking at my boat up on the screen, and she's like, that guy is not working as hard as Andrew is. That boat guy needs to pick it up a little bit.
Andrew, who's a freshman at Connecticut College, has to take his mom's word for the misrepresentation of his effort.
I have a disease known as Leber's congenital amaurosis, or LCA, and that means that some of the photoreceptor cells in my eyes didn't develop. And it's a genetic thing. It means that my only vision is really light perception, so I can tell if the lights are on, but that's about it.
The community rowing program hosting the regatta started out in a Quonset hut. It's been in business since 1985, and the opportunities being offered to athletes like Andrew Johnson and Oksana Masters have been part of the plan for years, as Jamie Hintleyan, the chairperson for the adaptive program, explains.
This is going to be one of the pillars of our program. We didn't just decide that we were going to be doing adaptive rowing because we have a brand new boathouse. It's been part of the mission of community rowing right from the very start of it. Rowing for all means rowing for all with really no boundaries. As you can see today, we don't have throngs of participants, but we've got this amazing cross-section of athletes represented, and athletes, by the way, that have been absolutely at the top of their game. It's remarkable.
Perhaps in part because these athletes don't constitute a throng, the rowers who are here are competing several times.
Attention, rope. Way out front, among the women, Oksana's got a slight lead over Beth. A little ahead of Laura, this is neck and neck right here. Stroke for stroke, 40 strokes a minute here, both of them.
This particular race has mixed the categories of arms-only rowers, arms and trunk rowers, and rowers who have some use of their legs as well, so it's something of a free-for-all. As the results of that race are announced, Oksana Masters chalks up another first. Laura Schwanger is paying close attention. Schwanger, who won a bronze medal in the arms-only rowing competition at the Beijing Paralympics last summer, is 50 years old. She's not sure she wants to dedicate the next 4 years to rowing, and so she's looking for athletes who might compete in London in 2012.
That actually is my goal this year. I've been traveling around promoting adaptive rowing. I'm really looking for the young woman to take my place. I did a lot of work last year. That's all I did last year, was trained for the Paralympics. And I don't know if I want to totally dedicate myself to one thing again. To find the people to take our existing national team members' place, that is my goal, yes. And I'm hoping that one of these women today will be out there to represent us in London.
Laura Schwanger's devotion to adaptive rowing followed her stint as a wheelchair basketball player. Next, she plans to learn to sail, but she has nothing but good things to say about rowing, and her only regret regarding the sport is that she didn't find it earlier in her life.
I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis while I was on active duty in the Army, and then a few years later I was in a car accident, so I'm
Double whammy.
Yeah, well, actually triple whammy. A couple years ago I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and that's what really started me to rowing after completing the treatment.
What eventually became a passion began as therapy.
I was extremely fatigued and weak. And friends in the Philadelphia area said, why don't you come out and start rowing with us? And we started on the rowing ergometers in December, and it took me 2 months before I could complete the workout that everybody else was doing. And, you know, I just got stronger and stronger and stronger. And then in May they said, hey, do you want to get in a boat? And it's like, sure, why not? But I really like the erg. And I was in the right place at the right time.
Even assuming that Laura Schwanger makes good on her current intention to retire from competitive rowing and move on to sailing, the U.S. will not necessarily be at a loss for rowers at the London Paralympics in 2012. Oksana Masters has her sights set on that competition, as does Beth Bryant, the woman with whom Masters finished first in that pairs race. But if cranking up the competition was part of the goal on that cold February morning at the community rowing boathouse, the greater achievement was evident in Laura Schwanger's summary of what rowing has done for her.
I turned 50 in November, and I am in the best shape of my life, both mentally and physically, and I can really have to credit rowing for this. This is a sport that you can do your entire life. I can't say that about other sports that I've done. You know, this is a lifetime sport, and it's a lot of fun, and the people are just incredible. Life is good.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti, and we had help this week from Brian Fadham. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view my adaptive rowing photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Peter Lufin, the designer of the adaptive rowing software that depicts rowing vessels gliding past leafy trees under sunny skies, regardless of the non-cyber season.
It does. We've carefully crafted this course to be as attractive as it can be under all local weather conditions.
Given this month's weather here in the Northeast, Lufin's craftsmanship was much appreciated. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.